He pointed one finger downward, made a fist, and rapped a knuckle on the surface of the tack board. I smiled and brought out the stones. "I think I'm finally getting my teeth into the game," I said an hour later after losing by the narrowest of margins. Braden pushed his chair away from the table with an expression of distaste.
"No," he said. "Quite the opposite. You have the basics, but you're missing the whole point."
I began to sort out the stones. "The point is that I'm finally close to beating you after all this time."
"No," Braden said. "That's not it at all. Tack is a subtle game. That's the reason I have such trouble finding people who can play it. Right now, you are stomping about like a thug. If anything, you're worse than you were 2 days ago."
"Admit it," I said. "I nearly had you that last time." He merely scowled and pointed imperiously to the table. I set to it with a will, smiling and humming, sure that today I would finally beat him. But nothing could be further from the truth. Braden set his stones ruthlessly, not a breath of hesitation between his moves. He tore me apart as easily as you rip a sheet of paper in half. The game was over so quickly, it left me breathless.
"Again," Braden said, a note of command in his voice I'd never heard before.
I tried to rally, but the next game was worse. I felt like a puppy fighting a wolf. No, I was a mouse at the mercy of an owl. There was not even the pretense of a fight. All I could do was run. But I couldn't run fast enough. This game was over sooner than the last.
"Again," he demanded.
And we played again. This time, I was not even a living thing. Braden was calm and dispassionate as a butcher with a boning knife. The game lasted about the length of time it takes to gut and bone a chicken. At the end of it, Braden frowned and shook his hands briskly to both sides of the board, as if he had just washed them and was trying to flick them dry. "Fine," I said, leaning back in my chair. "I take your point. You've been going easy on me."
"No," Braden said with a grim look. "That is far gone from the point I am trying to make."
"What then?"
"I'm trying to make you understand the game," he said. "The entire game, not just the fiddling about with stones. The point is not to play as tight as you can. The point is to be bold, to be dangerous, be elegant."
He tapped the board with two fingers.
"Any man that's half awake can spot a trap that's laid for him. But to stride in boldly with a plan to turn it on its ear, that is a marvelous thing."
He smiled without any of the grimness leaving his face.
"To set a trap and know someone will come in wary, ready with a trick of their own, then beat them, that is twice marvelous."
Braden's expression softened, and his voice became almost like an entreaty.
"Tack reflects the subtle turning of the world. It is a mirror we hold to life. No one wins a dance, boy. The point of dancing is the motion that a body makes. A well-played game of tack reveals the moving of a mind. There is a beauty to these things for those with eyes to see it."
He gestured at the brief and brutal lay of stones between us.
"Look at that. Why would I ever want to win a game such as this?"
I looked down at the board.
"The point isn't to win?" I asked. "The point," Braden said grandly, "is to play a beautiful game."
He lifted his hands and shrugged, his face breaking into a beatific smile.
"Why would I want to win anything other than a beautiful game?"
Chapter 66, Within Easy Reach. Later that evening, I sat alone in what I guessed might be my drawing room. Or perhaps my sitting room. Honestly, I wasn't entirely sure what the difference was. I was surprised to find I liked my new rooms quite a lot. Not for the extra space, not because they had a better view of the garden, not because the inlay in the marble floor was more pleasing to the eye, not even because the room had its own exceptionally well-stocked wine cabinet, though that was quite pleasant. No, My new rooms were preferable because they had several cushioned, armless chairs that were perfect for playing my lute. It's uncomfortable to play for any length of time in a chair with armrests. In my previous room, I'd usually ended up sitting on the floor. I decided to dub the room with the good chairs my lutery, or perhaps my performatory. I would need a while to come up with something suitably pretentious. Needless to say, I was pleased by the recent turn of events. By way of celebration, I opened a bottle of fine, dark Filoran wine, relaxed, and brought out my lute. I started quick and tripping, playing my way through Tintetatornin to limber up my fingers. Then I played sweet and easy for a time, slowly growing reacquainted with my lute. By the time I'd played for about half a bottle, I had my feet up and my music was mellow and content as a cat in a sunbeam. That's when I heard the noise behind me. I stopped in a jangle of notes and sprang to my feet, expecting Cauticus or the guards or some other deadly trouble. What I found was the mayor smiling an embarrassed smile, like a child that's just played a joke.
"I trust your new rooms are to your satisfaction."
I collected myself and made a small bow.
"It's rather much for the likes of me, Your Grace."
"It's rather little, considering my debt to you," Alvaran said. He sat on a nearby couch and made a gracious gesture indicating I should feel free to take a seat myself.
"What was that you were playing just now?"
I returned to my chair. "It wasn't really a proper song, Your Grace. I was just playing." The mayor raised an eyebrow.
"It was of your own devising?"
I nodded, and he motioned to me.
"I'm sorry to have interrupted you. Please, continue."
"What would you like to hear, Your Grace?"
"I have it on good report that Meloan Laclus is fond of music and sweet words," he said. "Something along those lines."
"There are many types of sweet, Your Grace," I said. I played the opening to Violet Bide. The notes rang out light and sweet and sad. Then I changed to The Lay of Savian, my fingers moving quickly through the complex cording, making it sound every bit as hard as it was. Alvaran nodded to himself, his expression growing more satisfied as he listened.
"And you can compose as well?"
I nodded easily.
"I can, Your Grace, though it takes time to do such things properly."
"How much time?"
I shrugged.
"A day or two, or three, depending on the sort of song you desire. Letters are easier." The mayor leaned forward.
"It pleases me that Threp's praise was not exaggerated," he said. "I will admit I moved you to these rooms with more than gratitude in mind. A passage connects them to my own rooms. We will need to meet frequently in order to discuss my courting."
"It should prove most convenient, Your Grace," I said, then chose my next words carefully.
"I've learned her family's history, but that will only go so far toward courting a woman."
Alvaran chuckled.
"You must take me for a fool," he said gently. "I know you'll need to meet her. She will be here in 2 days, visiting with a host of other nobility. I have declared a month of festivities to celebrate the passing of my long illness."
"Clever," I complimented him. He shrugged.
"I'll arrange something to bring the two of you together early on. Is there anything you require for the practice of your art?"
"A goodly amount of paper should suffice, Your Grace. Ink and pens."
"Nothing more than that? I've heard tell of poets who need certain extravagancies to aid them in their composition."
He made an inarticulate gesture.
"A specific type of drink or scenery. I've heard of a poet quite famous in Rhaenyra who has a trunk of rotting apples he keeps close at hand. Whenever his inspiration fails him, he opens it and breathes the fumes they emit."
I laughed. "I am a musician, Your Grace. Leave the poets to their superstitious bone-rattling. All I need is my instrument, 2 good hands, and a knowledge of my subject." The idea seemed to trouble Alvaran.
"Nothing to aid your inspiration?"
"I would have your leave to freely wander the estates and Severin Low according to my will, Your Grace."
"Of course."
I gave an easy shrug. In that case, I have everything I need for inspiration within easy reach. I had barely set foot on Tinnery Street when I saw her. With all the fruitless searching I had done over the last several months, it seemed odd that I should find her so easily now. Denna moved through the crowd with slow grace, not the stiffness that passes for grace in courtly settings, but a natural leisure of movement. A cat does not think of stretching. It stretches. But a tree does not even do this. A tree simply sways without the effort of moving itself. That is how she moved. I caught up to her as quickly as I could without attracting her attention. "Excuse me, miss." She turned. Her face brightened at the sight of me.
"Yes?"
"I would never normally approach a woman in this way, but I couldn't help but notice that you have the eyes of a lady I was once desperately in love with."
"What a shame to love only once," she said, showing her white teeth in a wicked smile. "I've heard some men can manage twice, or even more."
I ignored her jibe. "I'm only a fool once. Never will I love again." Her expression turned soft, and she laid her hand lightly on my arm.
"You poor man. She must have hurt you terribly."
"'Struth, she wounded me more ways than one."
"But such things are to be expected," she said matter-of-factly. "How could a woman help but love a man so striking as yourself?"
"I know not," I said modestly. "But I think she must not, for she caught me with an easy smile, then stole away without a word, like dew in dawn's pale light."
"Like a dream upon waking," Denna added with a smile.
"Like a fairy maiden slipping through the trees."
Denna was silent for a moment. "She must have been wondrous indeed to catch you so entire," she said, looking at me with serious eyes.
"She was beyond compare."
"Oh, come now."
Her manner changed to jovial. "We all know that when the lights are out, all women are the same height." She gave a rough chuckle and ribbed me knowingly with an elbow.
"Not true,"
I said with firm conviction.
"Well," she said slowly, "I guess I'll have to take your word for it."
She looked back up at me.
"Perhaps in time you can convince me."
I looked into the deep brown of her eyes. "That has ever been my hope." Denna smiled, and my heart stepped sideways in my chest.
"Maintain it."
She slid her arm inside the curve of mine and fell into step beside me.
"For without hope, what do any of us have?"
Chapter 67, Telling Faces. I spent a fair portion of the next 2 days under Stape's tutelage, ensuring I knew the proper etiquette for a formal dinner. I was already familiar with a great deal of it from my early childhood, but I was glad for the review. Customs differ from place to place and year to year, and even small missteps can lead to great embarrassment. So Stapes conducted a dinner for just the two of us, then informed me of a dozen small but important mistakes I had made. Setting down a dirty utensil was considered crude, for example. That meant it was perfectly acceptable to lick one's knife clean. In fact, if you didn't want to dirty your napkin, it was the only seemly thing to do. It was improper to eat the entirety of a piece of bread. Some portion should always be left on the plate, preferably more than crust. The same was true of milk. The final swallow should always remain in the glass. The next day, Stapes staged another dinner, and I made more mistakes. Commenting on the food wasn't rude, but it was rustic. The same was true of smelling the wine, and apparently, the small soft cheese I'd been served possessed a rind. A rind any civilized person would have recognized as inedible and meant to be pared away. Barbarian that I am, I had eaten all of it. It had tasted quite nice, too. Still, I took note of this fact and resigned myself to throw away half of a perfectly good cheese if it was set in front of me. Such is the price of civilization. I arrived for the banquet wearing a suit of clothes tailored just for the occasion. The colors were good for me, leaf green and black. There was too much brocade for my taste, but tonight
I made a grudging bow to fashion as I would be seated to the left of Maelowen Lackless. Stapes had staged 6 formal dinners for me in the last 3 days, and I felt prepared for anything. When I arrived outside the banquet hall, I expected the hardest part of the evening would be feigning interest in the food. But while I might have been prepared for the meal, I was not prepared for the sight of Maelowen Lackless herself. Luckily, my stage training took hold, and I moved smoothly through the ritual motion of smiling and offering my arm. She nodded courteously, and we made our procession to the table together. There were tall candelabra with dozens of candles, engraved silver pitchers held hot water for hand bowls and cold water for drinking glasses. Old vases with elaborate floral arrangements sweetened the air. Cornucopia overflowed with polished fruit. Personally, I found it gaudy, but it was traditional, a showcase for the wealth of the host. I walked the Lady Lackless to the table and held out her chair. I had avoided looking in her direction as we walked the length of the room, but as I helped her into her seat, her profile struck me with such a strong resemblance that I couldn't help but stare. I knew her. I was certain of it. But I couldn't for the life of me remember where we might have met. As I took my seat, I tried to guess where I might have seen her before. If the Lackless Lands weren't 1,000 miles away, I would have thought I knew her from the university, but that was ridiculous. The Lackless heir wouldn't study so far from home. My eyes wandered over maddeningly familiar features. Might I have met her at the Aeolian? That didn't seem likely. I would have remembered. She was strikingly lovely, with a strong jaw and dark brown eyes. I'm sure if I'd seen her there.
"Do you see aught that interests you?"
she asked without turning to look at me. Her tone was pleasant, but accusation lay not far beneath the surface. I had been staring. Hardly a minute at the table, and I was already putting my elbow in the butter. "I beg your pardon, but I am a keen observer of faces, and yours struck me." Maelowen turned to look at me, her irritation fading a bit.
"Are you a Tourajour?"
Tourajours claim to be able to tell your personality or future from your face, eyes, and the shape of your head. Pure-blooded Vintic superstition.
"I dabble a bit, m'lady."
"Really?
What does my face tell you, then?"
She looked up and away from me. I made a show of looking over Maelowen's features, taking note of her pale skin and artfully curled chestnut hair. Her mouth was full and red without the benefit of any paint. The line of her neck was proud and graceful. I nodded. "I can see a piece of your future in it, m'lady." One of her eyebrows went up a bit.
"Do tell."
"You will be receiving an apology shortly. Forgive my eyes, they flit like the calanthus, place to place. I could not keep them from your fair flower face." Maelowen smiled, but did not blush. Not immune to flattery, but no stranger to it either. I tucked that bit of information away.
"That was a fairly easy fortune to tell," she said. "See you anything else?"
I took another moment to search her face. "Two other things, m'lady. It tells me you are Maelowen Lackless, and that I am at your service." She smiled and gave me her hand to kiss. I took hold of it and bowed my head over it. I didn't actually kiss it, as would have been proper back in the Commonwealth. Instead, I pressed my lips briefly onto my own thumb that held her hand. Actually kissing her hand would have been terribly forward in this part of the world. Our banter was stalled by the arrival of the soups, 40 servants placing them before 40 guests all at once. I tasted mine. Why in God's name would anyone make a sweet soup? I ate another spoonful and pretended to enjoy it. From the corner of my eye, I watched my neighbor, a tiny older man I knew to be the Viceroy of Bannis. His face and hands were wrinkled and spotted, his hair a disarrayed tousle of gray. I watched him put a finger into his soup without a hint of self-consciousness, taste it, then push the bowl aside. He rummaged in his pockets and opened his hand to show me what he'd found.
I always bring a pocketful of candied almonds to these things, he said in a conspiratorial whisper, his eyes as cunning as a child's. You never know what they'll try to feed you. He held his hand out. You can have one if you like. I took one, thanked him, and faded from his awareness for the rest of the evening. When I glanced back several minutes later, he was eating unabashedly from his pocket and bickering with his wife about whether or not the peasantry could make bread from acorns. From the sound of it, I guessed it was a small piece of a larger argument that they had been having their entire lives. To Meluin's right, there was a Yilish couple, chatting away in their own lilting language. Combined with strategically placed decorations that made it difficult to see the guests on the other side of the table, Meluin and I were more alone than if we had been walking together in the gardens. The mayor had arranged his seating well. The soup was taken away and replaced with a piece of meat I assumed was pheasant covered in a thick cream sauce. I was surprised to find it quite to my taste.
So, how do you think we came to be paired? Meluin asked conversationally. Mr.
Quoth. I made a small seated bow. It could be because the mayor wished you to be entertained, and I am at times entertaining.
Quite.
Or it could be I paid the steward an incredible sum of money. Her smile flickered again as she took a drink of water. Enjoys boldness, I thought to myself. I wiped my fingers and almost set the napkin on the table, which would have been a terrible mistake. That was a signal to remove whatever course was currently being served. Done too soon, it implied a silent but scathing criticism of the host's hospitality. I felt a bead of sweat begin to trickle down my back between my shoulder blades as I deliberately folded the napkin and laid it on my lap.
So, how do you occupy yourself, Mr. Quoth?
She hadn't asked as to my employment, which meant she assumed I was a member of the nobility. Luckily, I'd already laid the groundwork for this. I write a bit. Genealogies. A play or two. Do you enjoy the theater?
Occasionally. Depending.
Depending on the play?
Depending on the performers, she said, an odd tension touching her voice.
I wouldn't have noticed it if I hadn't been watching her so closely. I decided to change the subject to safer ground. How did you find the roads on your way to Severin? I asked. Everyone loves to complain about the roads. It's as safe a topic as the weather. I heard there has been some difficulty with bandits to the north. I hoped to excite the conversation a little. The more she talked, the better I could get to know her.
The roads are always thick with rue bandits this time of year, Meluin said coldly.
Not just bandits. Rue bandits. She said the word with such a weight of cold loathing in her voice that I was chilled to hear it. She hated the rue. Not the simple distaste most people feel for us, but a true, sharp hate with teeth in it. I was saved from making a response by the arrival of chilled fruit pastries. To my left, the viceroy argued acorns to his wife. To my right, Meluin slowly tore a strawberry pastry in half, her face pale as an ivory mask. Watching her flawless, polished nails tear the pastry into pieces, I knew her thoughts were dwelling on the rue. Aside from her brief mention of the Edema Rue, the evening went quite well. I slowly set Meluin at her ease, talking casually of small things. The elaborate dinner lasted 2 hours, giving us ample time for discussion. I found her to be everything Alvaron had suggested, intelligent, attractive, and well-spoken. Even the knowledge that she loathed the rue could not entirely keep me from enjoying her company. I returned to my room immediately after dinner and began to write. By the time the mayor came to call, I had 3 drafts of a letter, an outline of a song, and 5 sheets filled with notes and phrases I hoped to use later. "Come in, Your Grace," I glanced up as he entered. He hardly seemed the same sickly, doddering man I'd nursed back to health. He'd put on some weight and looked 5 years younger.
"What did you think of her?" Alvaron said. "Did she mention any suitors when you spoke?"
"No, Your Grace," I said, handing him a folded piece of paper. "Here is the first letter you will want to send to her.
I trust you can find a way of delivering it to her secretly. He unfolded it and began to read, his lips moving silently. I labored out another line of song, scratching out the cording alongside the words. Eventually, the mayor looked up. "Don't you think this is a little much?" he said uncomfortably. "No." I paused in my writing long enough to gesture with my pen toward a different piece of paper. "That one is too much. The one in your hand is just enough. She's got a streak of romance in her. She wants to be swept from her feet, though she'd probably deny it." The mayor's expression was still doubtful, so I pushed myself away from the table and set down my quill. "Your Grace, you were right. She is a woman well worthy of pursuit. In a handful of days, there will be a dozen men in the estates who would gladly take her to wife. Am I right?"
"There are already a dozen here," he said grimly. "Soon, there will be 3 dozen. Add another dozen she will meet at dinner or walking in the garden. Then another dozen who will court her merely for the chase. Of those dozens, how many will write her letters and poems? They will send her flowers, trinkets, tokens of affection. Soon, she will be receiving a deluge of attention. You have one best hope." I pointed to the letter. "Act quickly. That letter will catch her imagination, her curiosity. In a day or two, when the other notes are cluttering her desk, she will already be awaiting the second one of ours." He seemed to hesitate a moment. Then, his shoulders bowed.
"Are you sure?"
I shook my head. "There are no certainties in this, Your Grace. Only hopes. That is the best one I can give you." Alvaron hesitated.
"I know nothing of this," he said with a hint of petulance. "I wish there were some book of rules a man could follow."
For a moment, he looked very much like an ordinary man and very little like the Mayor Alvaron at all. Truthfully, I was more than slightly concerned myself. What I personally knew about courting women could comfortably fit into a thimble without taking it off your finger first. On the other hand, I had a vast wealth of secondary knowledge. 10,000 romantic songs, plays, and stories taken all together had to be worth something. And on the negative side, I'd seen Simon pursue nearly every woman within 3 miles of the university with the doomed enthusiasm of a child trying to fly. What's more, I had watched 100 men dash themselves to pieces against Denna like ships attempting to ignore the tide. Alvaron looked at me, his face still showing honest concern. "Will a month be enough time, do you think?" When I spoke, I was surprised by the confidence in my own voice. "Your Grace, if I cannot help you catch her in the space of a month, then it cannot be done." Chapter 68, The Cost of a Loaf. The days that followed were pleasant ones. My sunlight hours were spent with Denna in Severin Low, exploring the city and surrounding countryside. We spent time riding, swimming, singing, or simply talking the afternoons away. I flattered her outrageously and without hope, because only a fool would hope to catch her. Then I would return to my rooms and pen the letter that had been building inside me all day. Or I would pour out a torrent of song to her, and in that letter or song I said all the things I hadn't dared to tell Denna during the day. Things I knew would only frighten her away. After I finished the letter or the song, I would write it again. I would dull its edges a little, remove an honesty or two. I slowly smoothed and stitched until it fit Melo and Lackless as snugly as a calfskin glove. It was idyllic. I had better luck finding Denna in Severin than I ever had in Imre. We met for hours at a stretch, sometimes more than once a day, sometimes 3 or 4 days in a row. Though, in the interest of honesty, things were not perfect. There were a few burrs in the blanket, as my father used to say. The first was a young gentleman named Jared, who accompanied Denna on one of our early meetings down in Severin Low. He didn't know her as Denna, of course. He called her Elora, and so did I for the rest of the day. Jared's face held the doomed expression I had come to know very well. He had known Denna long enough to fall for her, and he was just beginning to realize his time was drawing to an end. I watched as he made the same mistakes I'd seen others make before him. He put his arm around her possessively. He gave her the gift of a ring. As we strolled the city, if her eye focused on anything for more than 3 seconds, he offered to buy it for her. He tried to pin her down with a promise of some future meeting, a dance at the Defer's manse, dinner at the Golden Board. The Tenpenny King was being performed tomorrow by Count Abelard's men. Individually, any of these things would have been fine, perhaps even charming. But taken together, they showed themselves as pure, white-knuckled desperation. He clutched at Denna as if he were a drowning man and she a plank of wood. He glared at me when she wasn't watching, and when Denna bid the two of us goodbye that evening, his face was drawn and white as if he were already 2 days dead. The second burr was worse. After I'd been helping the mayor court his lady for almost 2 span, Denna disappeared. No trace or word of warning. No note of farewell or apology. I waited for 3 hours at the livery where we'd agreed to meet. After that, I went to her inn, only to find that she had left with all her things the night before. I went to the park where we had taken lunch the previous day, then to a dozen other places where we'd made a habit of each other's company. It was near midnight by the time I took the lifts back to the top of the Shire. Even then, some foolish part of me hoped she would greet me at the top, rushing into my arms again with her wild enthusiasm. But she wasn't there. That night, I wrote no letter or song for Maelowyn. The second day, I ghosted through Severin Low for hours, worried and wounded. Later that night in my rooms, I sweat and cursed and crumpled my way through 20 sheets of paper before I arrived at 3 brief, half-tolerable paragraphs which I gave to the mayor to do with as he wished. The third day, my heart sat like a stone in my chest. I tried to finish the song I'd been writing for the mayor, but nothing worthwhile came of my efforts. For the first hour, the notes I played were leaden and lifeless. The second hour, they grew discordant and faltering. I pressed on until every sound my lute made grated like a knife against teeth. I finally let my poor, tortured lute fall silent, remembering something my father had said long ago. Songs choose their hour and their own season. When your tune's tin, there is a reason. The tone of a tune is your heart's metal, and there's no clear water from a muddy well. All you can do is let the silt settle, or you'll sound sour as a broken bell. I lowered my lute into its case, knowing the truth of it. I needed a few days before I could productively return to courting Maelowyn on the mayor's behalf. The work was too delicate to force or fake. On the other hand, I knew the mayor would not be pleased with a delay. I needed a diversion, and since the mayor was too clever by half, it needed to be at least halfway legitimate. I heard the telltale sigh of air that signaled the mayor's secret passage opening in my dressing room. I made sure I was pacing anxiously by the time he came through the doorway. Alvaron had continued to put on weight in the last 2 span, and his face was no longer hollow and drawn. He cut quite a figure in his finery, a creamy ivory shirt and stiff jacket of deep sapphire blue. "I got your message," he said brusquely. "Have you finished the song, then?" I turned to face him. "No, Your Grace. Something more important than the song has come to my attention." "As far as you are concerned, there is nothing more important than the song," the mayor said firmly, tugging the cuff of his shirt to straighten it. "I've heard from several people that Maelowyn was greatly pleased with the first 2. You should focus the whole of your efforts in that direction." "Your Grace, I'm well aware that—" "Out with it," Alvaron said impatiently, glancing at the face of the tall gear clock that stood in the corner of the room. "I have appointments to keep." "Your life is in further danger from Cauticus." "I'll give this to the mayor. He could have made his living on the stage." The only break in his composure was a brief hesitation as he tugged his other cuff into place. "And how is that?" he asked, apparently unconcerned. "There are ways for him to harm you other than poison. Things that can be done from a distance." "A spell, you mean?" Alvaron said. "He means to conjure up ascending and set it to bedevil me?" Telu anyway, spells and sendings. It was easy to forget this intelligent, subtle, and otherwise educated man was little better than a child when it came to arcane matters. He probably believed in fairies and the walking dead. Poor fool. However, attempting to re-educate him would be tiresome and counterproductive. There is a chance of that, Your Grace, as well as other more direct threats. He dropped some of his unconcerned poise and looked me in the eye. What could be more direct than ascending? The mayor was not the sort of man to be moved through words alone, so I picked up an apple from a bowl of fruit and polished it on my sleeve before handing it to him. Would you hold this for a moment, Your Grace? He took it suspiciously. What's this about, then? I walked over to where my lovely burgundy cloak hung on the wall and retrieved a needle from one of its many pockets. I'm showing you the sort of thing Caudicus is capable of, Your Grace. I held out my hand for the apple. He gave it back, and I looked it over. Holding it at an angle to the light, I saw what I'd hoped for, smudged onto the glossy skin of the apple. I muttered a binding, focused my alar, and pushed the needle into the center of the blurry imprint his forefinger had made on the apple's skin. Alvaron twitched and made an inarticulate noise of surprise, staring at his hand as if it had been unexpectedly, say, pricked with a pin. I'd half expected him to rebuke me, but he did nothing of the sort. His eyes went wide, his face pale, and his expression grew thoughtful as he watched the bead of blood swell on the pad of his finger. He licked his lips and slowly put his finger into his mouth. "I see," he said quietly. "Such things can be guarded against?" It wasn't really a question. I nodded, keeping my expression grave. "Somewhat, Your Grace. I believe I can create a charm to protect you. I only regret I didn't think of this sooner, but with one thing and another..." "Yes, yes," the mayor waved me into silence. "And what will you require for such a charm?" It was a layered question. On the surface, he was asking what materials I would need. But the mayor was a practical man. He was asking me my price as well. "The workshop in Caudicus's tower should have the equipment I need, Your Grace. What materials he doesn't have on hand, I should be able to find in Severin, given time." Then I paused, considering the second portion of his question, thinking of the 100 things the mayor could grant me. Money enough to swim in. A newly crafted lute of the sort only kings could afford. I felt a shock run through me at the thought. An Antressor lute. I'd never even seen one, but my father had. He'd played one once in Annalyn, and sometimes, when he'd had a cup of wine, he would talk about it, his hands making gentle shapes in the air. The mayor could arrange this sort of thing in the blink of an eye. All that and more, of course. Alvaron could arrange access to 100 private libraries. A formal patronage would be no small thing either, coming from him. The mayor's name would open doors as quickly as the king's. "There are a few things," I said slowly, "that I have been hoping to discuss with Your Grace. I have a project I need assistance to pursue properly, and I have a friend, a talented musician who could use a well-placed patron." I trailed off meaningfully. Alvaron nodded, his gray eyes showing he understood. The mayor was no fool. He knew the cost of a loaf. "I'll have Stapes get you the keys to Caudicus's tower," he said. "How long will this charm take to produce?" I paused as if considering. "At least 4 days, Your Grace. That would give me time for the muddy waters of my creative well to clear, or time for Denna to return from whatever errand had pulled her suddenly away. If I was sure of his equipment, it could be sooner, but I will have to move carefully. I don't know what Caudicus might have done to foul things before he fled." Alvaron frowned at this. "Will you be able to continue your current projects as well?" "No, Your Grace. It will be rather exhausting and time-consuming. Especially since I'm assuming you'd prefer I be circumspect while gathering my materials in Severin Low.
Yes, of course. He exhaled hard through his nose. Damn and bother! Things were going so well. Who can I bring in to write letters while you're occupied? He said the last musingly, mostly to himself. I needed to nip that thought in the bud. I did not want to share credit for Maelowin's courtship with anyone. I don't think that will be necessary, Your Grace. 7 or 8 days ago, perhaps, but now, as you say, we have her interest. She's excited, eager for the next contact. If a few days pass with nothing from us, she will be disappointed, but more importantly, she will be anxious for the return of your attention. The mayor smoothed his beard with one hand, his expression pensive. I considered making a comparison to playing a fish on a line, but I doubted the mayor had ever engaged in anything so rustic as fishing. Not to presume, Your Grace, but in your younger days, did you ever attempt to win the affection of a young lady? Alvaron smiled at my careful phrasing. You may presume. Which did you find more interesting? The ones who leapt to your arms straight away, or those who were more difficult, reluctant, even indifferent to your pursuit? The mayor's eyes were far away with remembering. The same is true of women. Some cannot bear it when a man clings to them, and they all appreciate space to make their own choices. It's hard to long for something that is always there. Alvaron nodded. There is some truth in that. Absence feeds affection. He nodded more firmly. Very well. 3 days. He glanced at the gear clock again. And now I must be— One final thing, Your Grace, I said quickly. The charm I will make must be tuned specifically to you. It will require some of your cooperation. I cleared my throat. More precisely, some of your— I cleared my throat. Substance. Speak plainly. A small amount of blood, saliva, skin, hair, and urine. I sighed internally, knowing that to someone of the superstitious Vintic mindset, this would sound like a recipe for ascending or some other equally ridiculous thing. As I'd expected, the mayor's eyes narrowed at the list. While I am no expert, he said slowly, those seem to be the very things I should avoid parting with. How can I trust you? I could have protested my loyalty, pointed out my past service, or brought to his attention that I'd already saved his life, but over the last month, I'd come to know how the mayor's mind worked. I gave him my best knowing smile. You are an intelligent man, Your Grace. I'm sure you know the answer without my telling you. He returned my smile. Humor me, then. I shrugged. You're of no use to me if you're dead, Your Grace. His gray eyes searched mine for a moment, then nodded, satisfied. Very true. Send a message when you need those things. He turned to leave. 3 days. Chapter 69. Such Madness. I made several trips to Severin Low to gather materials for Alvaron's Gram. Raw gold, nickel and iron, coal and etching acids. I acquired the money for these purchases by selling off various pieces of equipment from Cauticus's workshop. I could have asked the mayor for money, but I'd rather he thought of me as independently resourceful rather than an ongoing financial drain. Quite by coincidence, in the course of this buying and selling, I visited many of the places Denna and I had spent time together. I'd grown so accustomed to finding her that now I caught glimpses of her when she wasn't there. Every day my hopeful heart rose at the sight of her turning a corner, stepping into a cobbler's, raising her hand to wave from across a courtyard. But it was never truly her, and I returned to the mayor's estate each evening more desolate than the day before. Making things worse was the fact that Brayden had left Severin several days ago to visit some nearby relatives. I didn't realize how much I'd come to depend on him until he was gone. As I've already said, a gram is not particularly difficult to make if you have the proper equipment, a schema, and an alar like a blade of Ramsden steel.
The metalworking tools in Caudicus's tower were serviceable, though nowhere near as nice as those in the fishery. The schema was no difficulty either, as I have a good memory for such things. While I was working on the mayor's gram, I started a second one to replace the one I'd lost. Unfortunately, given the relatively crude nature of the equipment I was working with, I didn't have time to finish it properly. I finished the mayor's gram 3 days after talking to the mayor, 6 days after Denna's sudden disappearance. The following day, I abandoned my pointless searching and planted myself in one of the open-air cafes where I drank coffee and tried to find inspiration for the song I owed the mayor. 10 hours I spent there, and the only act of creation I accomplished was to magically transform nearly a gallon of coffee into marvelous aromatic piss. That night, I drank an unwise amount of scutton and fell asleep at my writing desk. Maelowin's song was still unfinished. The mayor was less than pleased. Denna reappeared on the 7th day as I wandered our haunts in Severin Low. Despite all my searching, she saw me first and ran laughing to my side, excited to tell me about a song she'd heard the day before. We spent the day together as easily as if she'd never left. I didn't ask her about her unexplained disappearance. I'd known Denna for more than a year now, and I understood a few of the hidden turnings of her heart. I knew she valued her privacy. I knew she had secrets. That night, we were in a small garden that ran along the very edge of the Shire. We sat on a wooden bench looking out over the dark city below, a messy splay of lamplight, streetlight, gaslight, with a few rare sharp points of sympathy light scattered throughout.
"I am sorry, you know," she said softly.
We'd been sitting, quietly watching the lights of the city for nearly a quarter hour. If she was continuing some previous conversation, I couldn't remember what it was.
"Beg pardon?"
When Denna didn't say anything immediately, I turned to look at her. There was no moon, and the night was dark. Her face was dimly illuminated by the thousand lights below.
"Sometimes I leave," she said at last. "Quick and quiet in the night."
Denna didn't look at me as she spoke, keeping her dark eyes fixed on the city below.
"It's what I do," she continued, her voice quiet. "I leave. No word or warning first. No explanation after. Sometimes it's the only thing that I can do."
She turned to meet my eyes then, her face serious in the dim light.
"I hope you know without my telling you," she said. "I hope I don't need to say it."
Denna turned back to look at the glimmering lights below.
"But for what it's worth, I am sorry."
We sat for a while then, enjoying a comfortable silence. I wanted to say something. I wanted to say it didn't bother me, but that would be a lie. I wanted to tell her all that really mattered to me was that she came back, but I was worried that might be too much truth. So rather than risk saying the wrong thing, I said nothing. I knew what happened to the men who clung to her too tightly. That was the difference between me and the others. I did not clutch at her, try to own her. I did not slip my arm around her, murmur in her ear, or kiss her unsuspecting cheek. Certainly, I thought of it. I still remembered the warmth of her when she had thrown her arms around me near the horse lift. There were times I would have given my right hand to hold her again. But then, I thought of the faces of the other men when they realized Denna was leaving them. I thought of all the others who had tried to tie her to the ground and failed. So I resisted showing her the songs and poems I had written, knowing that too much truth can ruin a thing. And if that meant she wasn't entirely mine, what of it? I would be the one she could always return to without fear of recrimination or question. So I did not try to win her, and contented myself with playing a beautiful game. But there was always a part of me that hoped for more, and so there was a part of me that was always a fool. Days passed, and Denna and I explored the streets of Severin. We lounged in cafes, attended plays, went riding. We climbed the face of the Shire using the low road just to say we'd done it. We visited the dock markets, a traveling menagerie, and several curiosity cabinets. Some days we did nothing but sit and talk, and on those days, nothing filled our conversations as much as music.
We spent countless hours discussing the craft of it, how songs fit together, how chorus and verse play against each other, about tone and mode and meter. These were things I'd learned at an early age and thought about often. And though Denna was new to this study, in some ways, that worked to her advantage. I'd learned about music since before I could talk. I knew 10,000 rules of melody and verse better than I knew the backs of my own hands. Denna didn't. In some ways, this hampered her, but in other ways, it made her music strange and marvelous. I'm doing a poor job of explaining this. Think of music as being a great snarl of a city like Tarbian. In the years I spent living there, I came to know its streets. Not just the main streets, not just the alleys. I knew shortcuts and rooftops and parts of the sewers. Because of this, I could move through the city like a rabbit in a bramble. I was quick and cunning and clever. Denna, on the other hand, had never been trained. She knew nothing of shortcuts. You'd think she'd be forced to wander the city, lost and helpless, trapped in a twisting maze of mortared stone. But instead, she simply walked through the walls. She didn't know any better. Nobody had ever told her she couldn't. Because of this, she moved through the city like some fairy creature. She walked roads no one else could see, and it made her music wild and strange and free. In the end, it took 23 letters, 6 songs, and though it shames me to say it, 1 poem. There was more to it than that, of course. Letters alone cannot win a woman's heart. Alvaron did a fair piece of his own courting, and after he revealed himself as Maelowyn's anonymous suitor, he did the lion's share of the work, slowly wooing Maelowyn to his side with the gentle reverence he felt for her. But my letters caught her attention. My songs brought her close enough for Alvaron to work his slow, garrulous charm. Even so, I can take only a small piece of credit for the letters and songs. And as for the poem, there is only one thing in the world that could move me to such madness. Chapter 70. Clinging. I met Denna outside her inn on Chalker's Lane, a little place called the Four Tapers. As I turned the corner and saw her standing in the light cast by a lantern hanging above the front door, I felt an upwelling of joy at the simple pleasure of being able to find her when I went looking. "I got your note," I said. "Imagine my delight." Denna smiled and made a one-handed curtsy. She was wearing a skirt, not a complicated dress of the sort a noblewoman would wear, but a simple sweep of fabric you could wear while bucking hay or going to a barn dance. "I wasn't sure you would be able to make it," she said, "it being past the hour most civilized folk have taken to their beds." "I'll admit I was surprised," I said. "If I was the sort of man to pry, I would wonder what kept you occupied until this most unseemly hour."
"Business," she said with a dramatic sigh. "A meeting with my patron."
"He's in town again?" I asked. She nodded. "And he wanted to meet you at midnight?" I asked. "That's odd."
Denna stepped out from under the inn sign, and we began to walk down the street together.
"The hand that holds the purse," she said, giving a helpless shrug. "Odd times and inconvenient places are the rule with Master Ash. Some part of me suspects he might simply be some lonely noble bored with ordinary patronage. I wonder if it adds some spice for him, pretending he's meshed in some dark intrigue instead of just commissioning some songs from me."
"So what do you have planned for tonight?" I asked.
"Only to pass time in your lovely company," Denna said, reaching out and linking her arm with mine.
"In that case," I said, "I have something to show you. It's a surprise. You'll have to trust me."
"I've heard each of those a dozen times,"
Denna's dark eyes glittered wickedly,
"but never all together, and never from you." She smiled. "I'll give you the benefit of the doubt and save my world-weary jibes for later. Take me where you will."
So we made our way to Severin High by way of the horse lifts, where we both gawked at the lights of the nighttime city below like the low-born Cretans we were.
I took her on a long stroll through cobblestone streets, past shops and small gardens. Then we left the buildings behind, climbed over a low wooden fence, and moved toward the dark shape of an empty barn. At this, Denna was no longer able to keep quiet.
"Well, you've done it," she said. "You've surprised me."
I grinned at her and continued to lead the way into the dark of the barn. It was full of the smell of hay and absent animals. I led her to a ladder that disappeared into the dark above our heads.
"A hayloft?"
she demanded, her voice incredulous. She stopped walking and gave me an odd, curious look.
"You obviously have me mistaken for a 14-year-old farm girl named..."
Her mouth worked soundlessly for a moment.
"Something rustic."
"Greta?" I suggested.
"Yes," she said. "You obviously have me mistaken for a low-bodiced farm girl named Greta."
"Rest assured," I said, "if I were going to try to seduce you, this isn't the way I would go about it."
"Is that so?"
she said, running her hand through her hair. Her fingers began to idly twine her hair into a braid. Then she stopped and brushed it out.
"In that case, what are we doing here?"
"You mentioned how much you enjoyed gardens," I said, "and Alvaron's gardens are particularly fine. I thought you might enjoy a turn about the place."
"In the middle of the night?"
Denna said.
"A charming moonlit stroll," I corrected.
"There's no moon tonight," she pointed out. "Or if there is, it's barely a slender sliver." "Be that as it may," I said, refusing to be daunted. "How much moonlight does one actually need to enjoy the smell of gently blooming jasmine?"
"In the hayloft," Denna said, her voice thick with disbelief.
"The hayloft is the easiest way onto the roof," I said. "Thence into the mayor's estates. Thence to the garden."
"If you're in the mayor's employ," she said, "why not simply ask him to let you in?"
"Ah," I said dramatically, holding up a finger. "Therein lies the adventure. There are 100 men who could simply take you strolling in the mayor's gardens, but there is only one who can sneak you in." I smiled at her. "What I'm offering you, Denna, is a singular opportunity." She grinned at me.
"You know my secret heart so well."
I extended my hand as if I were about to assist her into a carriage.
"M'lady?"
Denna took my hand, then stopped as soon as she put her foot onto the first rung of the ladder.
"Hold on. You aren't being genteel. You're trying to get a look at my dress."
I gave her my best offended look, pressing my hand to my chest.
"Lady, as a gentleman, I assure you..."
She swatted at me.
"You've already told me you're not a gentleman," she said. "You're a thief, and you're trying to steal a look."
She stepped back and made a parody of my courtly gesture of a moment before.
"My lord."
We made our way through the hayloft, onto the roof, and into the garden. The sharp sliver of moon above us was thin as a whisper, so pale that it did nothing to dim the light of the stars. The gardens were surprisingly quiet for such a warm and lovely night. Ordinarily, even at this late hour, couples would be strolling the paths or murmuring to each other on the bower benches. I wondered if some ball or courtly function had pulled them all away. The mayor's gardens were vast, with curving paths and cunningly placed hedges making them seem larger still. Denna and I walked side by side, listening to the sigh of the wind through the leaves. It was like we were the only people in the world. "I don't know if you remember," I said softly, not wanting to intrude upon the silence, "a conversation we had some time ago. We talked of flowers."
"I remember," she said just as softly.
"You said you thought all men had got their lessons in courting from the same worn book." Denna laughed quietly, more emotion than a sound. She put her hand to her mouth.
"Oh, I'd forgotten. I did say that, didn't I?"
I nodded.
"You said they all brought you roses."
"They still do," she said.
"I wish they would find a new book."
"You made me pick a flower that would suit you better," I said. She smiled up at me shyly.
"I remember."
I was testing you.
Then she frowned. But you got the better of me by picking one I'd never heard of, let alone seen.
We turned a corner, and the path led down the dark green